Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Brant Williams, in for Carrie Miller. If you're traveling through Minneapolis on Franklin Avenue near the American Indian Center around 7 o'clock Monday night, you may have witnessed this. I was there as a group of a few dozen protesters, including some Native American drummers, who, as they shut down the intersection of Bloomington and Franklin Avenues to protest the killing of Billy Hughes. Now, the details provided by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension are vague right now, but they say this weekend two St. Paul police officers shot and killed Hughes after a brief confrontation. You know, some of the protesters I spoke to there that night were people that I'd met at previous demonstrations against the police shooting deaths of Thurman Blevins, Justine Ruschek, Philando Castile, Jamar Clark, just to name a few. You know, and many of them appeared weary and frustrated, as if to say, you know, here we go again. It was almost as if they were going through some trauma themselves. So I want you to give me a call, 651-227-6000, or toll-free at 800-242-2828. Maybe you participate in demonstrations, not even necessarily about police shootings, but maybe you have similar feelings. Or maybe you're someone who's grown weary of seeing all these protests and demonstrations, and you wonder if they're doing any good. So later this hour, I'll be joined by a trauma specialist, Resma Menakem, and a professor of sociology at the University of California named David S. Meyer. But my first guest is Anthony Galloway. He's executive director of Arts Us. He's also a co-host of Counter Stories, which is heard here on NPR News. Anthony, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, you bet. Hey, Anthony, let me start by asking you, I want to talk to you about your personal experience with demonstrations and protesting. First of all, tell me, what do you get out there and demonstrate against or for?
Sure, absolutely. And it's funny, this just the fact that I was coming on here this morning sparked a very interesting conversation around the breakfast table. I'm actually doing some self-care right now, getting ready to head on and do some work with youth in this very similar vein. So I'm out at a lake in Darien, Minnesota, so that's what you hear in the background, the nature. But I was with groups of students at in Standing Rock, and one of the things that keeps that issue front and center is proximity to folks actually affected. So it's interesting that the question of fatigue comes up in a space where at the same time you can't turn away, you can't look away, because you are directly affected by the events that are happening. And so your willingness or need to get out there and to get onto ground and to raise the issue and make sure other folks don't let this go, because to keep the urgency and pressure on, is a lot different for those who are directly connected to the issue versus what I've seen from folks who are with me on the ground or with folks on the ground at one time, and then you don't see them at another time. There's kind of some distance there that makes it less present and urgent.
Right. So you're talking about, in particular with the Standing Rock protests, there were folks who came in from around the country and camped for a while and then left, but you're talking about also the people who remain there, the people who live there, are dealing day to day with those particular issues. Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And the beautiful thing that I saw there was an understanding that there needs to be cycles of folks to do particular things. And so even while we were there, there were elements of self-care, both culturally rooted with the Native peoples that were there, but then also with other folks that were coming in. So there was, you know, we marched into the camps with a group of students, and it like reinvigorated. The energy was buzzing all around, and it was like air that was coming in, because the protest was started by youth who had run to march to Washington. So that actually was an element that not only at Standing Rock, but many organizers doing demonstrations to keep these issues front and center across the country, they have keep that in mind.
And, you know, speaking of, you kind of mentioned, it almost sounds like talking about replenishment of the troops in a way. And I'm curious about how you feel about the importance of using media news sources to expose what's happening there and maybe inspire others to join in this particular demonstration.
So one of the problems that comes in, and this is what some of the things that we're dealing with talking with youth at we're an Afrocentric arts organization at ArtsUS, and that is the nuance, right? So the benefit of that is rallying, getting folks excited and all those types of things. But then we have this thing that happens where the nuance gets left. So I found this most recently in some of the recent deaths at the hand of police officers. Regardless of how you think the encounter should have gone, speaking about the issue, the underlying issue that folks are trying to bring forward versus the momentary incident starts to become an issue as you try to get folks rallied, right? So in some ways I can get folks rallied and excited about addressing the underlying issue that is trying to be put forward. But then other folks are like, well, we need to be dealing with this one specific one on the ground. And so it tends to be a kind of an ebb and flow. And so you have to be really strategic on the, because the nuance of reaching out, it's not like talking to somebody directly. And so there's some pros and cons that come up with that.
And we're getting people who are also calling in as well to join in this conversation. And if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. Let's just go to the phones right now, because I think we're going to get some interesting additions to our conversation. I want to go to Joe in Minneapolis. Joe, what's your question or comment this morning?
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is this. I'm amazed that people think that they can affect change with the police just by protesting. The solution in my mind is you get police brutality and you get police shooting individuals is because of the police union. You can't fire bad police. Therefore, over time, you get a multitude of police officers that are poor. Eventually, this leads to poor behavior, which is brutal somebody or shooting somebody for no reason.
Sure.
Real problem is you can't hire and fire at will. Therefore, you've got bad employees. Bad employees do bad things.
Joe, that's a good point.
Instead of protesting, they need to march down to the mayor or the city council, depending upon the police union.
Yep.
Contract is cut and change the police contract to be able to fire and hire at will.
Point taken, Joe. Hey, Anthony, let me ask you, because we've heard this point raised by protesters saying that, and maybe this is just like perhaps they're thinking of a both and approach, right? Doing the mm-hmm. direct action in the streets and protesting, but also going to the mayor's office, going to those centers of power and saying, look, here's another way we can address this problem by actually going and getting some changes made to how the police union and the police department disciplines officers.
Sure. So this comes to some of the nuance pieces we were talking about, the assumption that those things aren't being done. And so, when we talk about what has happening on the ground for the protest, there's an optical thing that you see. And my background is in ethnic studies, and we take students around the country to look at that and see that in context. When you saw a protest happening around the move for voting rights, for example, what you see on the ground and the spectacle to pull folks into the conversation is one piece that's happening. But the other pieces that are also happening, too, you have SCLC that was continuing to meet with officials and things like that the whole time protests are going on. And then those protests bring energy and add, folks' voices to it to get folks engaged. But there is a ground game that's happening at the same time that we may or may not be aware of. So folks are going to the mayor's office. Folks are putting pressure onto the mayor to force them to have to respond in ways that there may not have been that compilation without a very public outcry to go along with that other work.
Yeah, and Anthony, we'd got a comment from a caller who just left this message saying, this person says they feel completely overwhelmed, and they say it's impacting their mental and physical health, and they say they're bowing out. Now, Anthony, you had mentioned to me that you're in Darwin doing also a little self-care. How important do you think that is for someone who is conscious and paying attention to what's going on and getting involved?
So it's absolutely essential. So you get my energy up here because there is not enough of this. And the challenge is, and I think in our last counter stories, this point was brought forward with Miss Akua Ellis, who was speaking about the fact that she couldn't watch the Blevins video just to protect her heart. And to her, experience, because she has to safeguard a young black boy, and so you can do as much self care as you want, but there's, you know, in self care around protesting and having to take some time for myself and regroup and then get back out there, for some of us is possible, but for others, it's not as easy. I'm sitting here surrounded by a group of black folks who are trying to do some of that piece, but we can't get too far away from the conversation because we are the folks who are being affected in mass by a wide margin. And so there's only so much you can do. So it's that makes it even more essential to think about what fills you up, what cultural roots, what connections I can make to refill, whether it's working with youth, whether it's all these things. And you'll see this pattern. Many organizers will pop themselves into community events that are uplifting specifically so they can recharge.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have another caller who's calling us in. This is Iola in Minnetonka. Iola, what's your comment or question on the topic this morning?
So the feeling was actually summed up by another commenter of being overwhelmed. So my first police shooting I ever witnessed was actually on that same block that this shooting happened. We grew up in the house behind.
Which shooting are you talking about? I'm sorry.
The one in St. Paul.
Okay.
The 900
Billy Hughes. Okay.
Anthony.
Thank you.
Yep. I grew up behind the house. Behind that block, so on Central Avenue, if you're familiar with the area. So then to wake up and see on TV the same exact scene I saw when I was about 15 years old brought up feelings that were never really resolved. And very much like, yeah, I have to bow out of any of the protesting or any of, just pretty much bow out in self-care.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're going to talk some more about I encourage you to keep listening to the hour, because we are going to have a person who deals with trauma, and we're going to talk some more in depth about that. But Anthony, I want to one of the reasons why I'm glad to have you on this hour is because as someone who has been on the front lines in dealing with this sort of thing, I'm curious if you feel like you have any other advice for people like Iola in dealing with how they personally deal with all this.
So I went to school with Philando Castillo, and he was murdered blocks away from my house. And so one of the things that has come out of that was an area where there could be a response in a whole lot of different ways, but I'm so stuck because it was so close. And one of the things that folks in my school community who have graduated and went to school with Philando, the August 18th, there's a Central Honors Philando where they have an event that to raise money for scholarship programs to do something in the name. And so I want to just put forward that there are multiple facets to the work that is needed. There are folks who we need on the front lines to raise the issue, folks who are connected to folks who can make some difference. But we also have things that are done in the name of the tragedy that are also forms of protest. It's just that we don't put those together with being in the streets because we're used to myopically looking at just the marching that's happening on the ground. So, you know, what I would offer for folks is figure out some of the other ways that protests are being done, and let's expand that definition of what that looks like, feels like, and sounds like. And that can really bring some energy and allow you to have much more mixed engagement, which is necessary to keep the issues front and center so that they don't just fall away.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Brant Williams sitting in for Carrie Miller. This morning, we're talking about protest fatigue. Right now on the line, we've got Anthony Galloway. And I want to know from you out there, if you have a question or a comment, call us 651-227-6000, toll free at 800-242-2828. Maybe you are concerned about the types of protests you see out there. Maybe you have a problem with people blocking streets or the highways, or maybe it's professional athletes taking a knee in front of the national anthem. What do you think is the acceptable way to protest? These are all things that we're going to incorporate into our conversation this morning. And Anthony, let me go back to you as well with this. We're going to talk a bit more about, again, with social movements and the use of social media. But I want to get your personal take on how you use social media in trying to further the cause, to get the word out and to communicate with folks who perhaps are on the sidelines and draw people in. How do you use social media in that way?
Specifically counter narrative. So something happens and then a bunch of information floods out, right? And folks are wanting to do some work to have this conversation with folks who they historically may have disagreed with, or to try to bring up. There is information that is coming out that completely lacks nuance or context, right? So this was a perfect example when quote unquote, take a knee piece, where you have a group of folks who are both strategically and in an informed way trying to shift the narrative to the protest being about the flag, which was never the case. And that's highly, corroborated in a whole lot of different reporting. And then the folks who were involved themselves, Colin Kaepernick and the other football player, the serviceman who said, hey, this would be better for me. Always about the greater issue. Right. But things folks try to steer that into ways that are either more digestible or because they lack context or nuance in a couple of different ways. And so then it becomes about the flag. So one of the things that I have really been trying to do is to make sure to post and add context or nuance. So if I see a kind of a myopic conversation happening that's taking that nuance away, I start throwing in things to say, hey, so here's a big picture, here's a counter narrative, here's those things like that, to make sure that folks are equipped with just better information, so sure. It doesn't creep into this thing that is just so off of the main topic that. You're going to be stuck and your argument's not going to hold any weight.
But isn't that frustrating as well, though? I mean, I always feel like social media or debate by tweet is a really ineffective and perhaps defeating way of trying to get that nuance and have that kind of conversation. Don't you ever feel that way sometimes?
You said debate by tweet, right? So one of the things I don't do is debate. In words online.
Yeah.
And debate's not what we need. And unfortunately, we have a debate culture that is rooted in having to have a winner or a loser rather than some of the more conversive elements where it's like, hey, here's what I heard. What do you think about this? Questions, authentic questions, not gotcha questions in conversations online. I've actually had a very different experience with folks who I know have very clearly different political views that often co-opt our real discourse, who we actually have some really interesting engagement online and have actually brought folks in to participate against something because now they find a perspective that they can actually grab their hands on. Wait a minute, I had no idea that this was about this. Well, hold on.
Wow.
Because nobody wants to feel duped.
Yeah, yeah. That's good to know that perhaps there's some hope that people can actually have some meaningful social media-based discussions and especially hot topics like these. I'm going to go to the phones again. We've got Sue in Bloomington. Sue, welcome to the conversation. What would you like to contribute?
Well, I have some questions that are pretty basic, and I hope if neither of you can answer it, some expert can call in. I would like to know what the laws are about protesting. Do you have to get a permit? How long does it take? What if somebody gets injured in the protest, for instance, like a driver, if they run into the protesters or a protester that gets injured?
Sure.
Just some of the legal things so people know, because it's an American right to protest, but I'd like to know how do they do it formally?
Okay. Well, Sue, thanks for contributing that. Maybe we'll have some folks who are lawyers or those more versed in the law than I am. I'm not going to venture to. All I can tell you is just from my personal experience covering protests mostly in Minneapolis, how police officers will try to keep people safe. They may not try to stop them from protesting on sidewalks or even in streets. But that's as far as my legal knowledge will go. Anthony, do you have any other insights as far as what, at least on the end of a protester, what you've experienced is what those laws are?
Well, this is a very important question, just because a lot of times when you see things that become violent or something like that, you're actually seeing a very small part of the large mass of direction and of the folks on the ground. You can look at Ferguson, you can look at Baltimore, you can look at a whole lot of different places, and they tend to kind of spoil the whole thing when it's just a small group of bad actors who are causing that. And so I'm very interested and curious about the question from the standpoint of what happens when I come in when I come in, and in order to try to undo the purposes of a protest, I come in there and to disrupt the protest by acting as a protester and doing some violence or some negative things over here in order to derail the arguments of the folks who are on the ground marching for a reason, you know. And then the only other piece I'll add is that inherently protests are supposed to be countering systems. So, you know, if all protests were permitted and folks only moved when protests were permitted, we wouldn't have nearly the legislative change that we've had in many, many different years. So there's a whole lot of things wrapped up in those very important questions. I'm interested to hear those as well.
Sure. Well, tell you what, let's open up our discussion a little bit more. So we're going to bring in a few more guests to join in here. I'm going to be joined here by phone with trauma specialist Rezma Menakem. He joins us by phone, and also Professor David S. Meyer, who's a sociologist at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome, Rezma, and welcome, David.
Hi, good to be
here. How are you?
We're doing great. Thanks so much. Rezma, let me start with you. I understand you've probably been listening into some of the discussion, and I want to get to what's in your wheelhouse as far as your area of expertise here about this idea of experiencing trauma as someone. You're watching these videos that get posted, say, of police shootings of African-Americans by police officers. What's your sense of what kind of trauma this can cause to people who are just watching, who may not know these people, who have did not eyewitness, they were not there to see this? What's your sense of this?
Well, first of all, let me say, may the ancestors guide what I say, and also say, what's up, Brother Galloway? How you doing?
Hey, how you doing? good to hear you. Hey.
You too, man. So first thing I think about is that when we are watching something on TV or hearing about another black body that's being shot or torn apart, one of the things that happens is that we have a tendency to think just about personal trauma, right? That I'm watching this, or something happened to me, or something happened to me as a child, or something happened to me as an adult. What I really try and get people to understand is that the energy that you're seeing is not just personal. It is also historical. It's intergenerational. It's from persistent institutional trauma. Then we begin to kind of, and that's coupled with the personal traumas. So the energy and the tax, the black body taxation that happens from seeing another body being torn apart is real. And that's why the grief in the communities is so prevalent. That's why the anger in the community is so prevalent, is that's because we're not just dealing with our own personal traumas. We're also dealing with the historical trauma and the reinforcement from what's happening to us personally. So,
take that your point there too. And I want to here's what I want to make sure I'm clear on, and how you feel as far as how important is it for us to witness these events? I'm trying to find the balance between, you know, when do you click that link to watch that video, and when do you say, you know what, I need to prepare for this? How important is it for us to consider that?
So when you say you, are you saying you as an individual or you as a community? Because those are both of those have to be considered. So sometimes the community is, there are things personally, when I'm looking at my phone and I'm seeing that, there is an internal structure or internal checking in that begin that when I hear about this, that I begin to struggle with. That's not just me. It's there is an overall feel within the community that this is too much. It's just too much. And it's not just too much now. It's been too much.
Sure.
And so a lot of times, and I heard Brother Galloway talk about self-care. You know, we have this idea of self-care being so individual sometimes that we forget that it's both self-care and communal care. And sometimes our communal care processes are so tapped out that we don't have our own individual self-care, we can't tap into the communal self-care either.
Well, let me bring in a caller into this, because she's going right to this point. I think she'll add a lot to this conversation right now. This is Jan in Minneapolis. Jan, go ahead. What's your contribution to our conversation this morning?
Yeah, I'm Jan Mandel. I'm Anthony Galloway's high school teacher, also working with Resma. I work with the Irreducible Grace Foundation.
This is your life.
My first self-care point in high school.
And we work with youth of color. Resma's helped us, and we're training a team of youth of color to help teach self-care in the biology of stress in all communities, whether or not you're in school or a workplace or just with your family or you're in a protest. The idea is that you are learning to care for yourself in these situations. So what's important here is learning, like Resma said, self-care practices by yourself. But we found with our young people who are experiencing so much trauma, both personal and historical, that you need a community in order to be held accountable and cared for in some of these practices. So, you know, it's like I don't have a question, but I'm in the process of figuring out a solution in community where we can learn these practices. They teach the biology of stress. Yeah. They teach transforming your historical trauma, and they teach self-care and resilience. As young African-American people between the age of 20 and 30, they become the teachers of some of these practices that you have to do, whether you're in a march or outside of marches living in this country.
Jan, thank you so much for that. And I want to thank Anthony Galloway for joining us. He's gone, but we're back with – I want to bring this Professor David S. Meyer. He's a sociologist at the University of California, Irvine. I want to bring him into the conversation. Doctor, thank you so much for hanging out with us here and listening into the conversation.
Thank you. It's a very interesting conversation. You have some guests who are really on top of things and know what they need to do.
And let me ask you about something in particular that I was most intrigued by as kind of doing a little research on this. We have this study from the Pew Research Center, which showing that 68% of Americans say they have what we're calling news fatigue, which I think is something, it sounds like a kind of fatigue that's on the part of people who don't engage in protests. So I'm curious to ask you if you feel like, if you've seen any evidence that shows that people who start to tune out what they feel is maybe disturbing news, or these are people who are also starting to withdraw from expressing their own views on issues in public, whether that be in through protest or just engaging with people who maybe disagree with them. Do you see anything about that, about this effect of this news fatigue?
Well, the news fatigue thing is a snapshot. And working for social justice is a long, or any cause, is a long haul struggle in the United States. And we think about really short stories when we look at our histories that wind up distorting what really happened. So Rosa Parks one day got tired, refused to move to the back of the bus, and boom, segregation ended. While Rosa Parks was an activist for a dozen years before that and 40, 50 years after that, you know, the we tell short stories about, like, one event, but in real life, the struggle continues, and you have to be able to engage for a long haul. And if you're engaged for a long haul, that means sometimes you take the night out and go out for a movie or have dinner with a friend. Or sometimes, instead of going to a protest, you maybe send $10 to a politician whom you like, or you write a letter, or an op-ed, or you go to a community meeting or a church meeting. And so the focus on the dramatic event leads us to forget the broad texture of civic engagement that social change demands. So people don't go away, or don't go away for very long, but they're not always doing exactly the same thing on the same street with the exact same protest sign up there.
Yeah, well, you know, Dr. Meyer, I'm guessing that, you know, when, well, I it's true that when Rosa Parks was holding, when she sat down on the bus and that protest movement was spawned in Montgomery, Alabama, or Birmingham, Alabama, or Montgomery, that there was only a few sources of news, right? And today we're in a situation where we are constantly exposed to events that are happening not only locally, but around the country and around the world. Do you get a sense that that's also contributing to the sense of fatigue that we're having, that we can't turn it off, it seems like?
Well, you can always turn off your phone. You can always stop looking at your phone. It's changed the way things are done in the sense that it's easier to get large numbers early in a early in the course of a movement, because you can get your own information out and you're not dependent upon mainstream media to get your own information out. And you can use social media to build broad and diverse networks of engagement. The downside of that is it's easy for people to avoid news that they don't like and just Google the experts that they think they like. Occupy Wall Street got very little attention for its first few weeks, but the computer geeks that they had in Zuccotti Park were able to get their own news out. The kids from Florida, the Parkland kids, the amazing Parkland kids, didn't depend on mainstream media to get their message out. They seized Twitter and they said, we're going to be very clear that such a shooting is never going to happen again. That's the urgency and activism in youth, and it's very inspiring. Yeah. And these kids were smart enough to learn that despite their urgency and activism, it did happen again. But yeah, they didn't give up. They're continuing to engage. It's a long-haul struggle, and this is something as Americans we have to learn, that our history is filled with long-haul struggles.
Yeah, and we had a comment left by a caller who'd said, in her words, she says, I can't help but think that protest fatigue comes with a whole lot of privilege. And she says, yes, that's something that we should discuss. Dr. Meyer, when people feel like, you know, I'm just tired of this, maybe they're not the people who are being directly impacted by that, by these issues.
Everybody gets tired sometimes. People who say, I'm tired of this and therefore I'm not going to come out tomorrow, have the luxury of doing that. That's a different story when you can disengage. I think everybody feels fatigue. And I think your caller who talked about building communities of support was really on the right track, in the sense that if you go to a meeting and you see friends and you see people you know care about not only the cause but also about you, who you can talk about your kid's Little League game with also, or talk about, you know, a new recipe that you're trying or how you're doing in school, it's easier to stay engaged when you look forward to seeing the people you work with. And the struggle of building a community of struggle is something that experienced activists deal with all the time.
Yeah. Hey, Reza, let me bring you back into here, because I think when we talk about this, again, about fatigue and who experiences it and for what different reasons, I think Anthony had mentioned it earlier in the hour that when you go to communities that are constantly affected by certain issues, whether it be police shootings or poverty or whatever, that they have a certain level of trauma that someone who just comes in and protests doesn't experience, except for that, their involvement in that particular event or protest or demonstration. What's your thoughts on that?
So first, you know, I think that, you know, when we begin to talk about fatigue and what's the impact of protesting on the body, you know, I always go back to the fact that, you know, first we're dealing with, you know, genocide of people, dealing with land theft, we're dealing with enslavement. And those things have not been resolved in this country. And so certain people and certain groups of people have been impacted by that. So there is a level of just both physical, emotional impact. And I'm talking about all the way through the body that certain groups and certain people have experienced. So now you now deal with this, the murder of a black body or the murder of a Native body or the shooting of a Native body or the shooting of a black body. And now you sit up here and there is a cumulative impact on that, on the body. So when I hear people say, well, you know, I am just so sick and tired of seeing these people on protest, seeing these people protesting, that rings different in my ear, mm-hmm, than saying I'm tired or I'm tired of seeing black bodies shot.
Sure, they're focusing more on the response than they are the initial action that caused the response. You're saying
exactly, and so there are people that are impacted by this daily. I don't get to move because of the construction of this country and how it was predicated on the white body being the supreme standard of humanness.
Yeah,
and I don't get to move out of that simply because I don't like what I'm seeing on the news. It's still, whether I click on the link or not,
yeah,
I'm still inundated in this country with messages and images about who I am as deviant from human.
Well, Rezma, thanks for that. And let's go to some callers. We've got a lot of people who are waiting online who have things to contribute. And I want to go to Julie in Minneapolis. Julie, thank you so much for waiting. And what's your question or comment?
My comment is this. I think you're hitting on it perfectly. I think as the middle class or upper middle class white people have lost a sense of discomfort. And for me, I kind of got reactivated around Philando Castile. And I went up to Duluth to protest when Trump was there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like I'm giving the money, I'm going to the meetings, I'm doing all the things, although on the outside I'm a spoiled upper middle class white person. But at the same time, you wonder if any of it breaks through, if it means anything. When I look at what really changed the tide with the detention centers, it was the audio recording, the visceral pain and suffering of hearing those children that finally broke through for average people. And I just wonder if we have to completely rethink our tactics. I just wonder if the world we live in now, the old tactics don't really work, and we have to break through this numbness from media that we have to truly get people to feel it. I don't know what the answer is, but I think as someone who's trying to be activated, you start to wonder if we're doing the right thing.
Sure,
we're focusing our energy the right way.
Well, Julie, thanks for that comment. I'm going to just bring in another caller I think has another who's going right to your point as well. I'm going to go to Chris in St. Paul. Chris, thank you for joining us. And what's your question or comment?
Hey, good morning. Thank you for allowing me to be on the show. Be patient with my frustration, please. So I am one of the people who do experience protest fatigue. And as such, I don't protest much. I did do the gun violence protest with the youth at the Capitol. I was there at the visual for Thurman,
yep.
Who was a father of a student of mine at Jenny Lind Elementary School. And so I'm traumatized by all of this. And so with my fatigue, what I've chosen to do is protest a different way through politics. And the reason why I chose to do that is because I listened to all the screams. Philando Castile is what got me involved.
Yeah.
And it took me over a month to watch his video, just like I'm not going to click it. And when I did, I was appalled.
Yeah.
And so I hold accountable the people who are in office and who are currently running for office that are in office, because over the years, like your gentleman host, guest is saying that it's systematic, historical, institutionalized racism that's in the policies. And so I would champion, like you guys said, the right to work for the police. You know, the one caller that said, you know, protesting don't work. How about we just have the ability to hire and fire at will, like teachers at charter schools? Like, I've had them kind of employments all over the place as civil servants. They're civil servants, too. And so it's no-brainer to do what needs to be done. Because that's what the protesting is all about. You have thousands of people screaming the same thing. It's the people that sit in these bureaucratic offices that don't want to help us.
So do you run for office? Do you just seek to replace them then?
So I'm running for federal Senate right now to speak to every office that's above it and below it, because I think Minneapolis, Minnesota itself is in a state of emergency for people of color.
Chris,
huge civil rights violations across the board, and the police killings are just one of them.
Chris, thank you so much for that contribution. And I want to bring in Dr. Meyer again, and I want to get a sense of if you feel like there have been movements that have gone from street protest and demonstrations, direct actions, to actually having those people who have been protesting being elected into office have just gone and just said, look, I'm just going to go right to City Hall or the state capitol.
Well, Well, I mean, for sure. We know about Representative John Lewis. If you look at photos from the early civil rights movement, you'll see over and over again this small, resolute man getting beaten, and now he's in the U.S. Congress, and he's a hero. And it's not just people you like. I mean, John Lewis, I find completely admirable. Your former Congresswoman, Michelle Bachmann, came out of a social movement for Christian schools and ran for office successfully. So a lot, the idea that activists can go into office, that happens all the time, and it's a long, long American history. I think the thing that your callers are wrestling with is that we desperately want like a magic recipe that's going to fix whatever problem we identify. And it's like, oh, if we use orange signs this time, or if we have a demonstration with the faster song at the end rather than the slower song, then that's going to be the thing that changes things. But in real life, political activism is a lot of improvisation, and you don't know exactly what's going to work this time and how and who's going to be inspired. But if you build a broad and diverse and abiding movement, you're more likely to be able to take advantage of critical events when they occur.
Yeah, Resmi, you had a reaction to what the professor was saying there. What did you want to say about that?
So two things. First one is that what he's saying in terms of wanting the quick magic wand, you know, solution is really this is what I hear people saying that they're fatigued. It's because they haven't seen an answer yet. There is no solution. And the fact of the matter is that this thing is as you said is a long, long haul, and you don't have. Some of us don't have the luxury of coming up with one magical thing that's going to work to uproot white supremacy. And I think that we have to get out of that notion that there's one thing or one way to do this, and that all of the things that we're trying to do are important. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
The second thing that I'd like to say is, you know, my brother is a police officer, been a police officer for 25 years, and we have a lot of discussions about social movements and being a black police officer and the types of things that happen to police officers. And one of the things that I think gets missed out of discussion is that you have some police who are in there who understand the value of community.
Yep.
And then you have, but the structure is not built on that value.
Sure.
And the structure of policing is not built on that. And so you have a lot of police officers who get fatigued, who have all of these traumatic things that happen to them, and the structure of policing does not recognize that.
Yep.
And I have been really pushing to make sure that that the structure of policing begins to get changed so these types of shootings don't continue to happen.
Right, right. Hey, let me bring in another caller who may address some of this as well. Let's go to Deborah in St. Paul. Deborah, thanks for waiting. And what's your question or comment?
My comment is, why do we have to keep fighting these battles over and over again, whether it's civil rights, women's rights? We don't realize the powerful forces that we're up against. And if we, you know, are kept busy marching and making placards, we're distracted. I mean, the whole issue of civil rights should have been addressed with Reconstruction. And it was working, but that was purposely derailed by the Northern Congress people and Southern lawmakers.
Yeah.
Derailing it. And we shouldn't have to keep doing this over and over again.
Right. So we have this you're talking about this. We have these structures that have been in place for a long time. And Dr. Meyer, I think this may be something you can address as well.
Yeah, it's
Do we
tough.
Get
it's
a sense of this,
like,
this the long game here? Are we aware of this?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, like, yeah, let's talk about Reconstruction. Sure, there's a good new book about Reconstruction. Maybe there'll be a musical about Ulysses S. Grant. Very interesting guy. But you know, the social justice work is not apocalyptic. I mean, you know, we want quick answers. We want to fix stuff. The struggle is going to be out there tomorrow. Okay, so you wash your kitchen floor and your kid comes in and spills something on it. What do? You go and you clean it up. You know, you're not done because you cleaned up the mess once. I had a good meal last night, and then, damn, I woke up this morning and wanted to eat again. Yeah. You know, you want to get good in math. You don't study one night and say, well, I should have learned it in elementary school. You still have to learn it now. It doesn't go away. Right.
So we need to change our expectations about how the actions that we take these days, if you're out there doing the work one day, you feel like people need to just get a better sense of what this is really going to take if you want to see change. And perhaps drawing on the experience of past movements. Is that kind of what you're saying as well?
And if you fire one cop or even charge and imprison one cop who shot somebody unjustly, that doesn't fix the problem. That's a positive first step. But it's a very long road.
Yeah. And Rezma, just give me your sense of, again, as people are taking this, as the professor explained, this long road, do you recommend that people just turn off for a while? You can ignore some of these videos that are coming because, you know, this is going to keep going on. This will be there for you when you decide to reengage.
Absolutely. Well, you have to unplug from time to time. You have to. One of the things that people forget in terms of social movements that I think the professor hit on is this idea of co-creating culture. That what successful movements do is that they co-create a different place and a different culture for people to belong to, not just strategy, not just creating placards, not just creating slogans, not just slowing down the song, but actually creating culture. So when I see you, so when I feel you, so when my proximity is to you, I can get closer to you. So when I am tapped in terms of my own ability to tap into my own resilience, I can now tap into my community's resilience. And I think most people who think about protesting are not thinking about, this is about co-creating culture. They're thinking about, this is an issue that I'm mad about, and so therefore I'm going to use my body in this specific time to let people know that I'm mad, but not understanding that this is about co-creating culture that can hold people in a way that actually produces a different culture.
I'm going to try to fit in one more caller here if I can before we close up our discussion. We've got Deirdre in Minneapolis. Deirdre, thank you so much for waiting. What would you like to contribute today?
I would like to contribute a request for a panel, possibly next week, of Indigenous and Black women who are boots on the ground, in the streets, in city council meetings, in community meetings. I would like to hear from those voices, those Indigenous and Black voices. Within the last month, we have lost another Black man, and we have lost a Native life this last week. We are in a state of emergency, and City Hall last week did not even want to address that we are in an urgent state. Please have a panel of Indigenous and Black women's voices next week. We need to protect and elevate those voices. Yeah. That are boots on the ground that NPR does not cover. A lot of us white women need to hear those voices now.
Deirdre,
I'm a mother, I am concerned.
Thank you so much, Deirdre, for that concern. And Rezma, you were reacting as well to Deirdre's concerns very quickly.
Yes.
Just give a sense of how important it is for us to hear a wide variety of voices for the issues that we're concerned about that we want to demonstrate.
What I heard Sister Deirdre say is that not a wide variety, specific. That black women's voices and Native women's voices are central to this, and women's voices, period, is central to this. This idea of change does not start without women being really at the forefront of this.
Yeah.
And so I agree with her 100%.
Resma, thank you so much for that. That was Resma Menakem. He's a clinical social worker and trauma specialist. He's right now he's in Dallas. Thanks for calling in. And also, we were joined by David Meyer. He's a professor of sociology at the University of California in Irvine. And I want to thank all of our callers for contributing to our conversation this hour. You're listening to NPR News.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.